Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, welcome to another edition of Word in Your Ear. And we are joined tonight by a writer who was first commissioned in the mid-70s when he was 15 by a free newspaper that was distributed by an RAF base in King's Lynn
maybe.
In Norfolk. Am I right? I think I'm right.
Yes.
And what they'd asked for was a summer singles roundup. And they were fondly expecting glowing reports of Shawaddy Waddy.
Mungo Jerry.
Pilot. Mungo Jerry it would have been, exactly. Casey and the Sunshine Band. What they got instead was Swamp Dog, Millie Jackson, and some deep soul imports. Now, after he was immediately sacked, our guest reappeared, which he was.
The first of many sackings.
He reappeared at the Enemy, and since then has been responsible for some absolutely fantastic, beautiful, elegant, gorgeously chiselled, thought-provoking writing about music, a lot of which appears in this absolutely excellent compilation of his essays, It Gets Me Home, This Curving Track. Sinatra, he will tell you unforgettably, takes soiled five-pound words and makes them glisten like mystic opals, his voice like spring light clarifying a dusty catacomb. It's excellent. Ian Pedman. Yeah. So, Ian, firstly, where do you get the idea that the title for the book, It Gets Me Home, This Curving Track, where does that derive from?
Well, it's a W.H. Auden quote. I have to tell you, the working title of the book was something that's in the opening essay about Mod. It was, I look all white, but my dad was black, in the Pete Townsend song. And
what did your publishers say?
They said no. 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 Especially the American publishers. They said no. Yeah. It would have caused, at the very least, a Twitter storm, I think. And also, it may have been in bookshops, it may have turned up under Misery Memoir, I think. But,
yeah.
But that was the. I never thought it would really be the title. But it was the working title because that's what the essays are about. It's, you know, it's how did a. How did a gawky white guy in Norfolk end up listening to so much soul music and how it literally changed my life.
Which you did, because you spent a while, just after you left school, you were going to go to college, weren't you? And you just hitchhiked around to various northern clubs?
Yeah, right? I was going to go to art college. It was nothing to do. I never thought I'd be a writer. I always thought it'd be painting or something. You know. But, yeah, I ended up hitchhiking to all sorts of clubs and stuff. And then, because it was the punk years, I mean, even though I didn't actually like punk music that much, I just started sending stuff into the NME, you know. In one memorable occasion, I sent in a review of Wire at the West Drunkton Pavilion that I hadn't actually attended. And
the West Drunkton Pavilion was where all the tours used to start, wasn't it? It was the opening show on all everybody's tour.
I did see loads of great gigs there.
Did they rumble this?
No.
Did they print it?
Yeah. No. That was when I was still just sending stuff in to be accepted.
What was the first thing you had published in The Enemy?
It was the Stranglers and the Only Ones at Cambridge Corn Exchange, 1977, yeah.
What was the conclusion of it? Can you remember?
You can
quote us some of it. I know you can, because all writers can quote.
Avoid this band like the plague.
I can remember the opening, which whatever happened to all the heroes, all the existentialist De Niro's.
And that was the opening line.
Yeah. And I actually sent it in a phone box. I actually phoned it in.
How exciting.
It was at the time. You know,
you're calling in saying, get me copy. I'm going to read you something about the only words.
And, you know, you're standing in the middle of nowhere in Norfolk phoning this in, and then, you know, 5 days later it's the enemy. It was
incredibly
exciting.
Thrilling.
It is, yeah.
Really
it's
thrilling.
Yeah.
I suppose in Norfolk was one of those places where, you know, the presence of the enemy made an enormous difference to your life, didn't it, when it arrived on a Wednesday or a Thursday? Or
oh, well, I suppose, strictly speaking, the first thing I ever had published in the enemy was a letter I sent in to the letters page when I was still at school. And that was incredibly exciting.
About what?
I can't remember now, but it was similar to sending away for LPs as well, because I remember at the same time I was in grammar school in Downham Market, this tiny town in Norfolk, and in lunchtime I'd go to the shop which sold washing machines, sheet music, and albums. And if you wanted anything, you know, if there were any albums you really wanted, you had to order them, and they'd send away from them. And the first one I ever got was Sailing Shoes by Little Feet. So in my lunchtime, I'd go down there, you know, and every day for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then finally it was there. And you look at this thing, and it's a message from another world, you know.
Yeah,
it's like
absolutely.
Just the cover to start with. Before you even listen to it, it's like this strange other world that, you know.
So things were more powerful because you didn't see them. You know, you couldn't. You weren't going into a local Virgin megastore and flicking through the racks.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's a cliche, but in those days, that culture. If you read newspapers, the Times or the Guardian or anything, they didn't have pop culture in them. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no. It wasn't on the TV. It was John Peel was about the only thing, the only part of the establishment that had it in. So.
Yeah, Robin Denslow in The Guardian. That was about it, I think.
In my archives, I actually have... I actually wrote to the Listener when I was 16, I think, saying, can I do your weekly pop rock column?
16.
I've got the letter they sent back. Very, very polite, you know, politely turning me down.
What's your memory of the NME, then? Because I worked at the NME at that time. Like, I remember you. I remember you in the corner with a little pork pie hat on. And I think I seem to remember surrounded by bottles of booze a lot of the time, hammering furiously on a manual typewriter.
Well, some of the time, but...
It was a very intimidating place to be if you were freelance. You daren't volunteer opinions, but I remember saying I quite liked Slade at one point, and the whole place went quiet. You know? And I think I was sort of ushered out, never employed again.
Well, it was also, the other thing, though, it was enormous fun. You know, it's 1 minute you're in Norfolk doing nothing, and the next minute you're in, you know, I was only 18, 19, you know, so it was incredibly exciting to be in the midst of all that, you know, so...
But you weren't intimidated by people, because you might have been at the age of 18.
I can't quite remember. I was saying to someone recently, you know, the first few interviews I did with Annette Peacock, John Fay, Weather Report, and you'd think. I mean, I was actually quite a shy person as well, and you know, I didn't like interviews that much, and you think you would kind of run from it, but. I can't quite remember why, but it all worked out somehow.
So who was the first famous person you interviewed?
Famous? Well, it depends what...
Go on.
The first few interviews were Annette Peacock, who came to the door in a towel, having just got out of the shower. Dennis Bevel, John Fay, The Fall...
The Fall.
The Fall? How was The Fall? Let's stop you there. That's always interesting, isn't it?
I did two... Four pieces in short, one in 78, one in 79, 80. And I actually went up there and stayed with them for 4 or 5 days, you know, and it was... that was intimidating. I mean, because Marky Smith was a fully formed person.
And didn't he live in terrible squalor? The impression you got was...
No, it wasn't squalor, but... at all. It was, I mean, they were smoking a lot of dope and stuff, but it was more the fact that he was this fully formed person who had all these opinions and likes and dislikes and knew, you know, was absolutely certain about what he was doing and, in a sense, didn't change from when I knew him for the next 20 or 30 years. And it was very odd to meet someone like that who was only a few years older than, you know, you were yourself, who was absolutely, you know... I mean, but again, I must stress, it was also enormous fun. On one of the... Was it the first one or the second one? John Cooper Clarke bought me a cheese and onion pie, which is one of the great boasts of my life. You know, it's like the Fool went to play.
That should be the title of a memoir, shouldn't
Eric's in Liverpool. And he bought me a vegetarian cheese and onion pie, which was, you know, and at the time, but then years later, you think about it and it becomes this wonderful.
Well, it's the idea that years later people are still interested in those, in those names who at the time were just whoever you were sent out to interview on Tuesday. So let's talk about this book. What's the... Explain the, you know, what's in this book, because it's not stuff from all of your career, is it? This is relatively recent stuff, isn't that right?
No, it's all recent stuff. As I say, the working title, I Look All White, but My Dad Was Black, was the guiding principle, because... When I was asked to do it and looked at them, there seemed to be a theme that emerged, which was about this, about white musicians being hugely influenced by black music, or black musicians working with white producers and stuff. And I hadn't noticed it at the time, but it was there, so that's why they were put together, you know.
And so these are a load of long pieces that you've written over the last few years for, what, the London Review of Books and...
Yeah, and an American...
The Wire?
No, there's nothing from The Wire there, but from an American magazine called City Journal.
Right.
The deeply conservative American magazine. But...
And these are the editor, real long-form pieces, aren't they?
Well, the editor of the deeply conservative American magazine was a fan of the early NME stuff. I mean, this is what's happened throughout my life, is that people turn out to have read the NME at a crucial point in their life and have this a memory of, you know, whether it's accurate or not. But,
well, we're going to start by talking about James Brown, I think. I mean, James Brown and his childhood, your description of his childhood is it's extraordinarily revealing. It was a really miserable start to life.
Well, it's partly from the book. It's not, you know, it's a very good book.
You're reviewing a book, that's right.
Yeah. But that was the point of the essays was, I mean, a lot of essays about music are either about the life or they're kind of about the technique and the music, you know, and... at its best, I would hope that you'd be able to weave it together, you know. I mean, I'm very, very, very lucky with both those publications in that I was allowed months, sometimes years, to write these pieces.
Seriously?
No, most of the months. It's only the Prince piece that took a bit longer.
So seriously, your James Brown piece in here, which is wonderful, like the whole thing is absolutely wonderful. And it will be about, I don't know, what, 6,000 or 7,000 words long, maybe? Is it?
No, the Prince one is long. That one's slightly short, yeah.
Okay, but let's say it's 4,000 or 5,000 words. How long will it take you to do that?
Well, the first few in the book were didn't take that long. I think it's more a question of what I've read during my life and listened to, you know, and I've always wanted to do stuff like this. And... I've got a whole wall at home of books, you know, which I've read about these people, and always in the hope that at some point I'd be able to put it to some use.
Right, you know, right. Like, so it's things knowledge accumulated over a long period of time.
Yeah,
Going back to the start of James Brown's life, you get the impression it was so terrible, and give us some details about that, but it's so terrible that's where his relentless work ethic must have come from, constantly seeking to get out of the predicament he was in.
Well... like a lot of child abuse, I think, he repeated the pattern. That was very much the point, I think, is like his own childhood was one in which he was barely allowed any sense of a childhood, any sense of play, of just, you know... And later on, he took that own attitude towards his own musicians, I think. It was like, you're not allowed... He had... Every minute had to be accounted for. Everything was a question of control, and some of the musicians would be fined if their shoes weren't shined properly, or, you know, if they were even a semi-quaver off or something. So he repeated the own horror of his childhood throughout his own life, I think, which was one of the tragedies.
And you couldn't win, could you? Because, I mean, if you went along with what he wanted you to do, he thought you were weak. And if you resisted it, you were kind of exiled.
It was mind games throughout, I think. But, again, this repeats throughout the book with John Fay and other people, and they're not necessarily well-rounded people.
No, they're not. No.
But they produce this transcendent music, and Charlie Parker as well, of course. So you're in two minds. On the one hand, you know, they treated people in their life, especially the people who love them most, I think, treated them worse. The more you love them, the worse they treated you. But on the other hand, for some reason, it produced this incredible music, which we mustn't forget had never been done before at the time. You know, a lot of this stuff, no one had done what Charlie Parker or John Fay or James Brown had done before. You know,
you make the point with James Brown that his music was all about work, that you can hear the effort at absolutely every stage.
Well, he had a kind of he had a sense of his own politics. Is that work and money were the only things that mattered, that would get him out, you know, that would establish him and get him out of the horror that he'd grown up with, I think.
So talk about his relationship with the musicians, because, you know, you say that a lot of what people applaud in James Brown, in his music, wasn't necessarily his doing.
No, I think a lot of it had to do with Bootsy and other musicians who, because he'd get them in the studio and he'd kind of offer them very, very, very vague instructions about the mood or what was to be done. But again, you know, that it worked, you know. He challenged them, you know. He was like a father. He was like an awful kind of patriarchal figure who bullied them. But it did produce this wonderful stuff. So
how do you feel about it?
I mean, in the essays, I really don't want to take a moral position. I don't want to say, you know, especially in these times when it's very, you know, there's a lot of, I don't want to use
it's so true.
Phrase political correctness.
Oh, yeah, it's like Michael Jackson is the big issue now. Should we be listening to Michael Jackson?
It's a lot more complex at every stage of the way, I think. You know, I think there's a lot of pain there, you know, and it's very easy to condemn people like that, but they're repeating the pain of their past a lot of the time, I think, you know.
So, we've mentioned Charlie Parker. I wanted to include this because, I'll be quite honest, I don't know very much about Charlie Parker, and I wouldn't mind betting there are people in this room who don't know very much about Charlie Parker either, but are aware that he's the kind of acme of hip and, you know, jazz player who died, tragic circumstances and so forth. Charlie Parker is somebody you constantly refer to throughout your writing.
Yeah.
What is it about him?
Well, I think the person I refer to more is probably Billie Holiday, but yes, there's a lot in there about Charlie Parker. And again, I think it's in the essay there's a paragraph where I refer to the fact that his career wasn't actually that great, you know, it didn't have the classic arc. He did it all too fast, too soon, and he did one thing, and he did it very well, but he was a bit monomaniacal about it, you know, and it wasn't going to end well, I think. And I think there's a paragraph where I say, you know, he boxed himself in, you know. In the end, it's not a healthy life. You develop certain muscles at the expense of other muscles, and he gets very good at doing certain things, at improvising within certain bounds, but he's not good at, you know, at other things. And at certain times in my freelance career, I felt the same. You know, you can get very good at doing something. You wake up in the morning, there's a blank page, you fill it with 900 words or something, and you can get very good at that, but in the end, it doesn't lend itself to, well, to work like this. You know, you have to this sort of work takes more time and reflection and stuff. And he died before he could do that.
kind of thing.
You describe him as the first deep water jazz musician to capture the public imagination. So how did he do that? What was it that he was doing? Was it just the complexity and dexterity?
Well, no, I think it was more the gossip. I think it was more the fact that he was this flaming comet, you know. It was more the personal life. It was the drugs and stuff, you know. But trying not to use the word iconic. But, yeah.
But you're not a musician.
No.
Or are you?
Although, well, no. One of the reasons I think that I became a lot more sympathetic to some of these figures. I mean, in my teenage years, like a lot of boys, I did plunk away on the guitar and so on. And then 20, 30 years, put it down, nothing. And then through just completely accidental circumstances, I did start playing the guitar again 10, 15 years ago, taking it a bit more seriously and stuff. And I think it made me a lot more sympathetic to some of these people, because I think musicians are, like painters, are completely... I think they have a completely different mind from writers, you know. I think a lot of music writers are always looking for lyrics and meaning and stuff. And if you spend any time with musicians, or if you try to get into playing music yourself, you realise it's not like that at all. Musicians speak in kind of tones and textures and abstract stuff. I mean, it's never about meaning, I don't think, for a lot of them.
How did he manage to remain so productive? Because, you know, he was a heroin addict. At one point, you say he's virtually living in taxis. He would hire a taxi for 3 or 4 days and use it as a kind of bedroom and an office, a place to compose. And he just lived this absolutely reckless life.
Still,
and yet still, there were 400 recordings, I think, weren't there?
He was still fairly young,
left behind,
you know. And, but that's the mystery behind a lot of it, is what drives people. In fact, I think there's also a misunderstanding a lot of the time about, you know... what drugs do to people, and well, you could say the same about Keith Richards. You know, he did his best work on, you know, on heroin and stuff. You know, it's like people think it's kind of it's going to. I think there's a very short arc where people can be brilliant on drugs, but only probably for about 5 or 6 years or something. You know, and sadly, that was, you know.
I think you quote one case where he's as it must be mentioned in the book that you're reviewing, where he's out in the middle of nowhere in America at the
on
tour or something.
Yeah.
And he just heads out in pretty much into the desert.
He got off the train and just walked across the field.
Assuming there must be drugs out there somewhere.
Well, if I made the film, that would be the opening. You know, it's like... but that was what his life shaped around. And I'm not sure... I hope that the essay is manages to be kind of complex about that. It doesn't come down on one side or the other, you know. It doesn't say that he was a bad man or that this got in the way of that, because in each of these figures, I think they're very complex lives, you know.
Now, I think it's a point really well made throughout the book that it's the sound of these things that is what they're about. It's not what the lyrics mean or what they say in an interview. It's... You know, it's coming directly out of them.
I've wanted to write about for years. I think the one thing that I've been obsessed with down the years is the voice and singers mainly. And but not what they sing, not the supposed meaning, but the voice and how it affects us, which is far, far more difficult to write about, I think. Although it's very simple and complex at the same time.
I had a picture of a load of Frank Sinatra albums, which I've briefly lost here. But let's talk about Frank Sinatra, because that's, you know, one of your essay subjects is Frank Sinatra. It's Terry dealing with the technicalities out the back here, which you may hear clanking in the distance.
Also interesting, an only child with a doting mother. We were talking about this earlier, where there's three people in the book.
Yeah,
there's him,
yeah.
There's Elvis Presley, who we're going to talk about in a moment, and it's Frank Sinatra and Charlie Parker. All three of them only children, and with these adoring mothers who kind of propelled them forward, you know.
Well, that interests me. I think in my early days, if I'd been writing about it, I would try refer to certain other writers about it, and because, you know, you're young, you haven't that's the point about the NME, I think, is we were very young, we hadn't lived, we didn't know anything about life, we didn't know anything especially about the more difficult, more painful aspects of life. You know, you're just full of hurrah, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And those essays, I think, couldn't be written until certainly you've lived a lot more and, you know.
So talk to us about Frank Sinatra. You know, what's special about the way Frank Sinatra sings? Because you say, if we're only going to listen to one voice, it might as well be him.
Well, I think two, Billie Holiday and him. But okay. The fascinating thing about him is the difference between the song and the life, because the life is so showy and so... there's such violent swings, you know, it's vulgar and violent and, you know... then you come to the songs... And it's like a different person is singing them. He's barely there. He's got this thing that he can do. You wonder if he's even aware of how good he is at it, you know. He doesn't sing in the way that a lot of singers do now, especially soul singers, where it's all arrows to what you should be feeling, you know, showboating. He does the opposite of showboating, and I think he got that from Billie Holiday. Well, he admitted it. He learned from Billie Holiday how to almost absent himself from the singing. You know, it's
and some of that must have been to do with the arrival of the microphone. Because the microphone must have changed everything, because suddenly you had the possibility to have a really intimate relationship with an audience.
Well, I mentioned it in there, Bing Crosby was responsible for a lot of that. Everyone yeah. thinks of Bing Crosby as this strange, croaky old figure. But he was the Sinatra before Sinatra. He was obsessed. Most singers in those days had to belt it out to the back of the hall. That's, you know, with big, yeah. big bands behind them. But Crosby was the first to realise that recording the voice would change everything. And he actually spent a lot of time and money investigating how you could best record the voice. And he actually came up with some of the technology at the time, Bing Crosby. And Sinatra was obsessed with Billie Holiday and Bing Crosby, and he was the beautiful result of this.
Because the record, I think you talk about quite a bit, is the Sinatra, the kind of bossa nova record that he...
barely there.
Yeah, you put it on, you'd hardly notice it at all.
But at the same time, you can't ignore it. It's and you listen to that album, and it's like it's the opposite of Jekyll and Hyde. You know, it's like it's his good, it's the good Sinatra singing there. You know, it's like so subtle and
And didn't he listen to the way horn players played? And
yeah.
their breathing, and study that and use that as a kind of model for the way he's sung.
Well, when he started his own album, the first album he put out was Ben Webster.
Yeah.
He's a beautiful tenor saxophonist, and he also loved Lester Young. And it's what's not done, it's what's left out. You know, it's the gaps you leave, it's the kind of what you don't do that he learnt there, I think.
So contrast that with another singer you write about in the book, Elvis Presley, who was showy, wasn't he? What did you find to admire in him?
Well, I think that's the one figure in the book that wasn't actually someone that I loved or was a hero. But the more I read about him, the more I did feel that way about him. I felt an immense amount of sympathy for him, because I think he got trapped in the same way that Parker did, I think, because no one had ever done it before.
You know?
And it's like, and we all assume it would be a great thing to be the first rock and roll singer and everything, but perhaps it wasn't. You know, I think he was an essentially passive man who didn't expect, had no idea what was about to befall him. You know, to become this world-circling figure.
Well, the chapter starts in 1965. And him just wanting to get off the tour, wanting to give up. Now, why was that? And you know, he still had another 12 years to go, as it were. Well, what had happened in 1965 to make him feel that way?
I think the interesting thing in the book would be that the figure you might compare him with would be Prince, which isn't the first person you'd think about. But one of Prince's roadies said, once Prince had done Purple Rain, you know, he got everything he'd ever wanted, and then realised he didn't want it. And it's similar to Elvis Presley. They both retreat into themselves.
Yeah.
But what is the self they retreat into? Because they'd been very young when they started. So unlike most of us, they didn't have a chance to grow up, you know, to compare, you know, to have friendships, to find out different degrees of pain and love and stuff. They were just thrown into this strange world.
And also, as they say about celebrity, that you may remain frozen at the emotional age that you were when you first became famous. You could land up in your mid-30s still as a kind of 16-year-old emotionally. You
know? Well, there's almost a class thing there that is sympathetic to, you know, you come from this humble background and you're thrown into this thing and you're not prepared for it on any level, I don't think. But that's also what you hear in The Voice a lot of the time, I think, when they create their art, I think.
What, you hear that kind of loneliness in there?
I think so, yeah. And I think that's, for years now, what I've wanted to write about is that writing about the voice without necessarily writing about the lyrics.
Right.
What you can hear, the ghosts you can hear in the voice, I think.
Yeah. So the voice is essentially singing the same song.
Over and over again, you think.
Well, is there anything in that?
I don't know. Possibly, I don't know. The problem with Presley was I was never a fan, because I never liked The Voice. That was right. The problem. I mean, I eventually found some of his stuff, the Memphis stuff from the 70s that I liked. But previous to that, I was, I never mentioned it to anyone. But I wasn't a big Elvis fan. Same with John Coltrane, you know. For years, I never mentioned it. Don't actually like the way he sounds.
I'm with you there, but yeah. So
Although the things I did like with Elvis were the softer, slower things, the less rock and rolly things, you know, but where I thought you actually heard more of him, right. Possibly.
You made the point that you think Colonel Tom Parker's probably had a bad rap because he's the person who realised that Elvis was there to be looked at.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's not had an altogether bad rap. He wasn't, you know. But a fascinating man in himself as well, I think. You know, he was way ahead of his time, you know. These years he would be, well, he'd probably be in jail, but...
yeah. Well, you could argue that he didn't do much to arrest Presley's decline. I mean, he had some brilliant business ideas. I mean, I didn't know, for example, until I read your book, that he'd pressed up a load of hate Presley badges and distributed them to the people, all his dissenters.
Well, he understood just brilliant. The media before there was a media.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, again, that was one of the things that fascinated me. Like Presley, he was from a nothing background, but he had this idea in his head. He saw what was happening, you know, and other people didn't.
Do you think there's something about popular music that kind of suits people who come from nothing backgrounds, as you say? They can invent something in the world of pop music that they might not be able to do in theatre or...
Well, I mean,
performing arts.
The thing about the book is, I think, also it's almost like a disguised autobiography, you know, almost completely disguised. I mean, there would be no reason for me to write a memoir or autobiography. No one would be interested. But I think throughout the book there are paragraphs and sentences that are about that, because that's what the NME was like, as I said earlier. One minute I was working in H. Smith. What was it? Jewelers, High Street Jewelers, in 1978.
H. Smith, H. Samuel.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it was the jeweler, not the.
Yeah.
And then one minute you're doing that, and then the next minute you're, you know,
right.
Not prepared for it in some senses, like these figures.
Talk to us about Prince, who you write about in the book. What was your fascination with Prince?
Well, I think it's not my fascination, I think it's everyone's fascination, is he was so wonderful, and then he wasn't. I mean, what happened?
Is that true of so many people?
But it's true, you know.
Where did it go wrong?
Where do you draw the line?
I don't know. I'm reminded of the Nick Rogue film, where Gene Hackman, after years and years, discovers gold, and then he finally gets what he wants, and then after that, he's got nothing left to do. Just, and there's a quote from the film, all this leftover time to kill. And I think Prince, I think probably during the 80s, he had one of the most, I think he was probably one of the happiest people alive. And he was just throwing out these wonderful ideas and wonderful music and so on. And then at some point it stopped. You know, I do say in the book that it's, I describe it as a long and oddly dispiriting goodbye to Prince. Partly because I thought, I mean, I spent a lot of time on it, way too much time, but I thought I might get a hint of why it happened. But in the end, I had no idea. You know, it's like it's a very odd story. It's a very odd kind
of... But when he makes all the money and builds Paisley Park, he then, rather like Graceland, as you were saying earlier, he then disappears into Paisley Park and is kind of imprisoned by it to some extent, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, but I assume it started earlier. Again, there's a very odd upbringing, you know, with the father and mother. There's a lot of tension there. And what happens when you're called Prince? What happens when you're baptised Prince? You know, it's like from the beginning.
It's a rough start, isn't it?
Yeah. You live up to it. But I don't know. I'd like to be able to say I got some sense of why it went wrong, but it's very odd. I don't know.
So musically, what do you think? I mean, there he was producing, playing all the instruments, recording, doing entire albums.
Well,
on his own.
For one
what,
thing,
what was the main achievement musically, do you think?
Well, for one thing, it's very odd. If you listen back to those albums, the 80s, it was just one after another. They were wonderful. But he talks and sings, for instance, about sex relentlessly. But I get the sense that he wasn't a particularly erotic person. I get the sense that he wasn't a particularly soft or reflective or erotic person. He was a workaholic and someone who was happiest alone, completely alone. And that's one of the reasons at the end when I talk about his death is that it's inevitable that he died alone because, you know, his whole life had been that in a sense. He's got all this money, all this everything, but he's happiest alone for some reason, making not even making music with other people, but you know, doing it himself. It's a Citizen Kane thing, I think. There's a strange combination of utter ego and ruthlessness with a very odd kind of sadness or loneliness underneath it all, I think.
Do you do most of your kind of listening to music on record, or do you go to live gigs? Or in Prince's case, did
go
you go
to live gigs? No, I did. I did in the past. Obviously, I saw Prince's first ever gig in Britain. Yeah,
was that an important part of his appeal to you?
No, I preferred the recorded stuff. The first gig was actually a huge disappointment. I think I got the impression he'd thought, well, I'm going to play in Great Britain for the first time. They love Led Zeppelin and rock music. So he came and did this really guitar-y kind of... It was less like soul music than a kind of, you know, onslaught. And I was very disappointed. I think I actually walked out. I'm ashamed to say. But
you're not a big gig goer nowadays?
Oh, no.
Right.
Well, for one thing, I mean, it costs so much, but I've got terrible tinnitus in this ear, which I blame on dub music and Lou Reed when I was...
Oh, right, OK. It's too late to
but
take
no,
it out
it
with
is
Lou
actually
Reed.
Painful. I couldn't. I literally
oh, really?
Couldn't, no.
Oh, I see. So, well, to...
Do you go to a lot?
Not a lot, no. But if we talk about somebody quieter that you write about in this book, I'm delighted to see you write about him. John Faye.
Yeah.
The... acoustic guitar, well, calling him an acoustic guitar player seems not a particularly adequate way of describing him. For the benefit of anybody who might not have heard John Faye, how would you describe him?
Well, I did see him live. I did go to a... it was at the... there was a place in the late 70s in London called The Venue. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Dreadful, dreadful, depressing
yeah,
place.
Down in Victoria, yeah.
And after I interviewed him in 1979... we went along to see him, and it was so depressing. It's just this lone man in a suit on the stage with all sorts of Saturday night noise going on, trying to play the guitar, and it was just so depressed. Again, I walked out, I think. I was never a great gig goer. But no, he's
he's very principled. You talk about it in that chapter, which is really revealing, all about how
he's... He was a lovely man.
He was very against the kind of folk revivalists and thought they were just kind of hollow platitudes that they were copying. And he'd come to that music via the Harry Smith anthology, hadn't he? So he'd listen to bluegrass and
again, he was
American
a very complex
music.
Man who could be genuinely lovely. And, you know, when I met him and interviewed him, I was just a bumbling, you know, cub reporter. But he was gorgeous with me and... Just he could have talked all night, you know, but then you research it and find out that he could also be a horrible, horrible person to people. Again, people in his life nearer to him, you know, he could be a dreadful to them. But I think the difference between what you raised it going to gigs and sitting at home listening to music interests me, because when you get to our age, you know, you think there are certain records that you know you play over and over and over again, that like Steely Dan. And there are certain records from your past, save off the top of my head, Iggy and the Stooges. What does it mean when you're 60 to sit at home and put an Iggy and the Stooges album on? What do you sit and listen to it and, I don't know, what does it mean? Does it mean something completely different from when you were 17? Whereas there are other musics that seem to grow with you, you know, over the course of a life, that mean different things as you age as well. And I'd hope that one of the things in the book is kind of the opposite of not denying aging, because that's an interesting thing about a lot of the books now, is that pop was always about youth, you know, and now we're all writing from a completely different vantage, that we're all grown up, you know, very grown up.
Give us an example of something that's meant something different to you, a musician, a type of music that's meant something different over the years.
Well, I mean, Charlie Parker... who was it? Charlie Parker's a good example. There was another one I thought of yesterday, was it? It's more the different things that... yes, that's it. I was thinking about Miles and Kind of Blue... Because I bought a copy the other day of a remastered blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And when you're 16, 15, 16 or something, what will impress you with that record? It might be Miles or probably Coltrane, because you're pretending to your friends that you like that more radical side of it, you know. And then maybe you grow a few, you listen and you think, well, Miles is really subtle, I like that, you know. And then another decade goes by, and personally I became obsessed with Bill Evans, because he's barely there, he's like a ghost, and he's the only white guy in an all-black band, and at times you can barely hear what he's doing, but it's crucial what he's doing, it holds it together, you know. And recently, I was listening to it again. I was amazed at how Cannonball Adderley, the alto sax, is just fantastic in it. And for years I've listened to this and never really, you know... And also the drummer, I can't remember his name now, Jimmy Cox. Yeah. Is just crucial to it, you know. And again, very unshowy. Yeah. Very, you know... And I think that's partly a consequence of growing old, that you admire different things. You know, you can admire someone who's less showy and is prepared to do that, is prepared to serve the other people in the band.
In pop music, has Steely Dan done that with you? Have they kind of changed for you?
Well, definitely. I think when... I think, obviously, when you're a teenager, you like that they're smart, Alex. And that's a very teenage... Again, an example in film would be Taxi Driver. It's a very immature teenage film, I think. And there are aspects of Steely Dan that appeal to that teenage boy, I think, very much. But then as I think I say in the essay, if you keep with it long enough, I think there's a lot of pain in there as well. And I think that, especially with Donald Fagan, well, both of them, you only have to look at their lives, I think. You know, they were obviously keeping an immense amount in, you know, and in order to...
Which we never knew very much about. They never really, no. They never gave anything away.
Well, they were musos. They thought of themselves as jazz musicians, yeah, rather than rock musicians, I think. And there's a long tradition there, you know.
Ian does some terrific stuff on social media, on Twitter. And one thing you do, I think most evenings, you do a thing called First Drink Soundtrack.
Yep.
Well, yeah, I don't know. You just post, you know, I'm playing whatever you're playing. I don't know, John Martin or whatever. Which I think is really interesting because it kind of touches on what is one of the major challenges in music nowadays. That you've got all of it. What do you feel like playing? You know what I mean? What's front of mind? What are you in the mood for? You know, how do you do that? Do you sit there with a rack of vinyl on CD or whatever and then go along and pick out? Or,
well, what I've noticed is that, I mean, during the day, I mean, there were years in the past when First Drink Soundtrack would have been like 11 in the morning or... But these days, it's strictly, you know, never before five. But that's my wife laughing.
Very Danny Baker.
Hello, laugh. Yeah.
But I've noticed that, I mean, during the day, I listen to all sorts of stuff, you know, it's like African stuff, Schoenberg, whatever, you know, I mean, classical music. But the minute that it becomes First Drink Soundtrack, the minute that there's like two dozen records a lot of the time, and that will be the one I pick. And it's like some strange unconscious, and Steely Dan is one of them.
So do you go back to the same dozen or do
a lot
different
of the time
dozen?
Yes, right. definitely.
So what sort of things will they be? Steely Dan is one,
Little Feet is another. I mean, they're I think a lot of them are to do with when you first heard them, you know. And Roxy Music, the first two, three albums is another one, yeah. Billie Holiday is another one, yeah. There's all sorts of... I'd need a psychoanalyst.
Right. They go well with alcohol.
I don't know, because it's not... It is literally the first drink, so it's not, you know, it's not the fifth or sixth drink, but I don't know.
Now, another thing you post a lot about on social media, which fascinates me, is your wanderings around charity shops, which you've clearly spent an awful lot of time doing, looking at old, you know, vinyl or CDs
and annoying,
or whatever.
Find very, very rare things sometimes, which you pay kind of 50 pence for. So what are the really interesting things that you've
well,
discovered?
Well, it all started, I mean, again, it's to do with First Drink Soundtrack, partly. In the old days, when we all worked for magazines and stuff, I used to be, you know, addicted to magazines and stuff. I would go out and buy a whole bunch, whether it was New Yorker or Mojo or Q, and go to a pub and sit, you know, 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon. And then at a certain point, I decided it was unhealthy to be doing this. I've always said if there was a memoir about freelance life, it would be called Getting Out of the House. So once you've decided not to go to the pub during the day, you need another reason to leave the house. You need a destination. And it so happened that that's how charity shops came about. Instead of going to pubs, I started going to charity shops in the North London area. I was very lucky. I mean, this is in the days before I was on Twitter or anything, and it was in the days before it became a thing. You know, charity vinyl. And it was just, I had about 6 or 7 in the area, just, you know, and the first few things I found, I was very lucky to find some lovely stuff. Like today I was playing, I dug out these 4 Nina Simone albums, which was one of the first things I ever found in a shop in Seven Sisters Road. These 4 60s from the 1960s and 70s Nina Simone albums. One of them still had the price ticket on from Bieber.
Wow, brilliant. You left that on.
That adds,
yes,
value,
that
surely.
Is still there.
Not that's bad. Brilliant.
I might sell that in my...
Do you find that charity shops increasingly price things at ridiculous.
Some of them
values.
Do, a lot of them don't. I mean, it depends. I mean, if I live in like Holloway Road, Seven Sisters, so I'm still fairly okay. If you go down to Islington or into the West End, it can get ridiculous. But you can still find incredible bargains.
What's been your greatest find then?
I don't know. I mean, those Nina Simone ones. I mean, there's a lot that have. No, I don't know. I've thought about writing a book about it, not about going to charity shops, but using it as a way to. I don't know if anyone knows the film critic David Thompson. You know, Have You Heard? Where he goes through all these. I thought about doing a using charity shops as a way to talk about all sorts of different weird, you know, not weird, but stuff I found in charity shops, you know. Someone I love now, the French singer Leo Ferré, I first found in a charity shop, and I had no idea who he was, but I just took a chance on it and took it home and put this on, middle-aged guy singing in French that I almost blubbing, you know. I had no idea what he was singing about, but there was something about his voice. Again, we go back to singers and their voices, yeah. But and
well, you should write it, Ian. You should definitely write it. The book about
getting out of the house.
Getting out of the house. To follow up this,
it gets me out of the house.
This remarkable book, It Gets Me Home. This curving track,
it gets me out of the house. It gets me into the house. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I have to say, I finished this book the other day and immediately went and listened again to about six of the records that were mentioned within it.
Well, that's what I hope would.
And it's I cannot praise it too highly. It's absolutely terrific. And would you please thank our first guest this evening, Ian Penman.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.